Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for Autumn Semester 2022. The lecture will proceed until 4:20, at which time you'll have the promised surprise quiz to do, 15 minutes. Stay frosty while you're doing it. Do the easy problems first, and then go back and take on the more difficult ones. And you should do fine on the exam, on the quiz. But as usual, we'll have a look at the markets to start this whole thing off. Here we are. Let me ask you, see if you can help me out. Okay, sir, is this a good day, a bear day, or a bull day? Kind of a bear day. It started out, do you see how there was a bullish run there in the morning, and then it just turned sour, and it just started to drop. You saw there was, in the mid-afternoon, there was sort of a bull rally for a little while, but by the end, the bears had just kind of slaughtered it. Notice, interestingly, that this was one of those inverted days. The Dow was down the most at 1.11%, and then the S&P 500 was down less, 1.03%, and the NASDAQ was down the least. So usually you see the Dow in the opposite order, but whatever the bad news was, it certainly was much more adverse to the large, well, it was certainly more adverse to the large companies than it was to smaller companies. And once in a while you see that. Now, we had a really bad bear day a few days ago because of the interest rate hike by the Federal Reserve, and I'll be talking about that in today's lecture. But that was not, that would not be what was driving the market today. The market was in a bad mood for something else. If you look at the S&P 500, the volume of trading was thin. Compared to the typical day, the 500 large stocks in the S&P 500 traded only 2.6 billion, 100,000 million, yeah, 2.6 billion shares. On a typical day over the last year, it's been 3.7 billion. So we had a light day, and that usually tells you that the markets, the big dogs, or a lot of the money is staying off the playing field. A lot of uncertainty right now about where things are going from where they are right now. Now, interestingly, notice crude took a dive. Clear down. Remember, it had been in that trading range between about 82 and 89. Well, it broke the neckline on the downside seriously today. It's down to 76.47 on light Brent sweet. And so you should see in the next few days, well, toward the weekend probably, lower gas prices if this drop in oil continues. That's good news, obviously, for the economy. Lower gas prices, lower jet fuel prices, kerosene, diesel. So whether it's going to stay down there, that's interesting, though. But also interesting was that, look at all the gold and silver both took a nosedive today. So commodities were down. Stocks were down. Investors selling stocks. Commodities were down. Now here's the 10-year bond. Yields were up, meaning prices were down. So investors were getting out of bonds, too. So what does all this mean? The investors are getting out of stocks. They're getting out of bonds. They're definitely not climbing into commodities. So that would mean that the money is going to cash. It's going to the sidelines just to wait and see what's going to come next, what the next shoe to drop will be. Now, oddly, over in Tokyo, last night, they were just in a really bad mood, just sliding the whole day. down a noticeable amount than Nikkei was. Oddly, though, after the sun went down in Tokyo and rose in London, London started off with a positive spike, and then it just dropped through the ground, had a bull rally, and then it finished off just barely in positive territory. Now, notice that that's sort of what happened over here. We started off in positive territory, then the bears took over. Bulls tried to rally, but at the end here, the bears had finally gotten fully in control. So it's an odd pattern that the markets just are not in a good mood. And what the motivation is, well, your guess is as good as mine. It's just that there is concern about the global economy right now, and London is causing all kinds of worries with the drop in the value of the pound sterling. It's basically collapsing right now. So London, what happened in London again? Yeah, London is surprisingly chipper for being as what happened today with the pound sterling. But there's that. The topic of today's lecture is interest rates. And I would caution a couple of things. First of all, that the term, sometimes you'll hear me say interest rates are the price of money. That's not exactly right. It's a rental rate. Now, to do this appropriately enough, sir, I'll tell you what. If you lend me $100 today, I'll give you that $100 back in 1 year. I'm good for it. Does that sound good to you?
Yeah.
Really? Oh, we've got deals to do, my friend. Yes, indeed. Madam, you, $100 today, you give me, I'll give you back $100 in a year. Look at this. A true capitalist is born. Obviously, you are not, you're going to want something more than $100 back because you're giving up that $100. So at the base of all interest rates is this idea that there is an opportunity cost for giving up consumption. That's underlying an interest rate is you're saying, I don't get to have this money now. So I have to forego my current pleasure of having it and using it for whatever. And I want something, a compensation for that. I am renting money. And the rental rate, that's the interest rate you're going to charge. So this capitalist is going to charge me 10%. So I have to give her back $110 in 1 year. That is her rental rate for 1 year for money. Here's the thing, though, is interest rates are complicated. They have pieces to them. But underneath all interest rates, as I try to make sure that I have a marker that works, underneath all of them is an opportunity cost. Well, that one's dead. So let's try this one. An opportunity cost. Now, I will assume that you all had your economics courses, and I will also assume that you tried to purge as much of it out of your minds as you could right after the course was over. So the thing, though, is that when we're talking about an interest rate, there is a foundation rate that is driven purely by the supply and demand dynamics for money. We call that the real interest rate. And we would designate it with an R sub real. Now, with your economics class, you probably saw this. There is an amount of money, that's the horizontal axis, and a price of money. That's the real interest rate. The rental rate of money, I should say. Now, the demand curve slides down like that. At high interest rates, you don't want to hold a lot of money because you could put it in the bank and earn interest. But when interest rates are really low, no one's going to want money, okay? To put their money in the bank. The credit union, IS Credit Union, a couple of years ago, I walked in there, they had 3-year CD rate was 0.15%. I mean, you're giving up your money for 3 years for 0.15% per year. No one's getting, they were fussing, no one wants to put money into CDs. Well, duh, you're not getting anything. You'll just keep the money. So at low real rates, you will hold large cash balances. But if the interest rates are high, you'll put the money somewhere so it can earn some interest. That's all that demand curve for money says. Now, the one that seems a little bit odd is when the economists draw the supply of money curve. They draw it like a vertical line, perfectly inelastic. And all they're saying is that at any given point in time, there is a specific amount of money in the economy. It can't be affected in a short run by any kind of supply dynamics. So whatever the intersection of supply and demand is, that's your real interest rate. Now, what happened? We'll say supply one, real interest rate, equilibrium interest rate one. Now, back in about 2017, the economy was beginning to struggle with a recession. It was slowing down. And the president at that time did not want that to happen. So, the Federal Reserve should, at that point, have raised interest rates just to slow the economy down a little more, get us into a mild recession, shake it out, and get it over with. But the president at that time, he went so far as to threaten to fire the chairman of the Federal Reserve if the Fed contracted the money supply. Well, no one had ever threatened that before, and strangely enough, we did not even know if a president could do that. But that freaked the Fed out, and the Federal Reserve said, okay, fine, we'll just increase the money supply, which of course, I've got to find another marker. I'm beginning to die here for markers. And I don't have a, oh, there's one. Good. Okay, so they increased the money supply. And of course, interest rates fell, and that stimulated the economy. The real rate fell. Supply goes up. Price of the commodity, in this case money, goes down. Well, then something dramatic happened. It was called COVID. The economy shut down, and the Fed, trying to keep the economy from crashing into a horrible recession, printed more. And then Congress and the president at the time started handing out COVID checks, 3 rounds. Plus there were all these PPP loans, and then they forgave the money. And the Fed, and worse yet, we were struggling because taxes had been cut dramatically in 2017. For corporations, and so the supply curve of money was cranking. The Fed was just printing money hand over fist. And of course, that was pushing the real rate down even further. The problem was with all of this that it creates a long-term effect. And this is where one of those principles that is not particularly believed by most people known comes in. Inflation is a rise in the aggregate price level. If prices go up for cars, that's not inflation. If prices go up for meat, that's not inflation. True inflation is a cancer that is systemic. All prices are going up. That's what we're seeing now. All prices are rising. That is real inflation. But there is only one cause of real inflation, of actual inflation. The only thing that can create an aggregate systemic rise in all prices is too much money being printed. If the growth rate of the money supply exceeds the real growth rate of an economy, inflation has to be the result. No, inflation is not, well, these corporations jacked up their prices. That's what's causing inflation. No, it's not. That can't. Well, these wages and these minimum wages are going up. That's inflation. No, it is not. That cannot be inflation. So you had on the right-wingers, they were talking about, well, it's Biden inflation. And you had the leftists, like AOC, whining about this inflation is caused by corporations price gouging. She said that. And they're both off their rockers. That's not how it works. Look, if you've got an economy growing at 3%, real growth rate, it will need a growth of the money supply of 3% to keep the lubrication going. But if it goes up 4%, well, that 1% is going to cause prices to rise simply to correct the problem. That's how it works. It's just an engineering issue. But God knows, they don't want to talk about it in those terms. And most people, 90 to 95% of people in this country have no clue. That's why education for you is so important. We cannot educate the masses. All we can do is take care of them, let them bitch and fuss, and then clean things up as they get messy. What happened here was the secondary effect. An expected inflation premium begins to seep in. Now, I do apologize. I can't remember what designation the book gives for it. The traditional one was to represent expected inflation by the letter pi with the superscript E. And again, I think they call it INF or something like that. But what that is also there. So you see, what ultimately happens is as the Fed accelerates the printing of money, they can bring down the real rate, but ultimately, the backlash will be this son of a bitch, or this thing coming up. Sorry. So I've been teaching this for a long time. And that's what happens. But notice I didn't say inflation. I said expected inflation. Inflation is bad. Expected inflation is horrible. You, madam, I've decided I'm going to hire you as my employee. I mean, I 40 hours a week, and I'm going to pay you well, $100 a week. I know, $100 a week for, I'm a giver, okay? So you work for me for a year, and you come in for your annual review, and I say, well, you're a good worker, darn good worker. Well, I see inflation last year was 2%, so I'm going to give you a 2% rise. There's your damn raise, go, get back to work. Next year, you come in for your review, and I say, well, you're still doing great, and I see inflation last year was 4%, so I'm going to give you a 4% increase. Now get back to work. The next year, you come in, and I sit down, and I say, well, it looks like inflation last year was 6%, so I'm going to give you a 6% increase, and you say, stop right there, fat boy. And, of course, I'm shocked. No one's called me fat boy since high school. Hence why I dropped out. I hated that term. Okay? Why? You're going to say, I want 8%. Why was I cheating you every year? Okay? Think about it this way. You see, inflation had already been 2%, and then I give you 2%, you've already lost the 2%. When inflation was 4%, I give you 4% a year after it has been 4%, you've lost your 4%. You see, markets work on expectation. You want what you expect it to be, how much it's going to erode while you're earning it. Banks are the same way. When they charge you an interest rate, they're not going to look at what historically has happened. They're going to say, how much purchasing power is the money we lend going to erode over the life of this loan. It's going to be an expectation of inflation, not the actual inflation rate. See, the inflation rate can be bad, but the expectation can get embedded. Here's what happened, and I'll go through this in a lot of detail in a subsequent lecture. But back in the 60s and 70s, especially in the 70s, the money was being printed at an accelerating rate. We had the war in Vietnam. We had the oil price shock from the OPEC oil embargo. We had constantly the Fed was printing more money, and the inflation rate was going up. And so an expectation of inflation was beginning to seep in to the economy. The Fed would say, well, we're going to cut this inflation rate. We're going to drop the money supply and get it under control. But they didn't. They just kept printing money because politically they couldn't. They didn't want to take the damn necessary step, which would have thrown real interest rates through the roof, and the expected inflation premium was high. Interest rates would have gone cuckoo. Well, they finally did. But it was only in 1979 that they did it. So markets do not trust the Fed. When the Fed says, well, we're going to stop the inflation, the markets say, yeah, you've said that before. They're not going to, oh, well, we better cut that inflation rate, expected inflation premium. No, unions aren't going to do it. Companies aren't going to do it. Think about it this way. You're a business person. You will be business people. Are you going to charge based upon what you have already paid? Or are you going to charge based upon what you'll have to pay for the next order of your stuff? You're going to pay an expectation. You're going to charge an expectation of what's coming. You will never historically price. You will price based upon replacement costs. And if you think the replacement cost is going to be higher, you're going to put in your prices up. So you see how that expectation of inflation becomes like a cancer? And it's only when the Fed gets serious and does it, sustains it, that you can begin to drain that expected inflation premium out. The Federal Reserve this time is taking dramatic steps against inflation. I mean, it shocked the hell out of the market. They have jacked up the discount rate, which is their way of one of their ways of controlling inflation. Historically, the most times and the most amount. Normally, the Fed would jack up interest rates about 0.25%. Well, this last one was 0.5%. So they're saying, we're not messing around, hoping that that will get that expected inflation premium down quickly. Just get it over with. It's going to hurt like hell. The markets are having a cow right now, just going, oh my God, OMG, bear market. Fine. They're just doing what they have to make the markets understand, we're serious. We're going to stop this. You see, because interest rates are going up. Why are they going up? Because the Fed is clawing back the money supply. It is draining that liquidity overhang that's been building for the last 5 years. That's not an easy job. They're just literally draining the money out, shredding it, and causing, of course, real interest rate is going through the roof, and of course, the expected inflation premium is still staying stuck high. It will take a while, we hope not long, for the markets to say, oh, you're serious. And that will begin to make pi e, the expected inflation premium, drop to where we would like it to be, maybe 1-2%, and then the Fed can resume printing money. Let me show you. You can actually see it. Now, the one that we usually use for this as a benchmark is the one-year T-bill. It's sort of like what we call the risk-free rate, which is the sum of these two. The sum of these two is called the risk-free rate, and we designate it by an R sub F, like that. Okay, let's look at what's happened just this month. Look at the risk-free rate. Do you see the Fed? That is draining the liquidity. That is cutting that supply of money. You're seeing it with data. The graph is real. Look at this. Let me show you this. This one is from the beginning of the year At the beginning of the year, the 1 year T-bill yield was 0.4%. I mean, that's almost ridiculously low. And now, it's 4.17%. It is multiplied by a factor of 10. That is, now obviously some of that is the increasing expected inflation premium. See, the Fed is contracting the money supply, driving up the real rate, and expected inflation is still accelerating. So you put those two together and we've got the makings of a recession. Of course we do. That's what happens. That's why the Fed doesn't like to do this. That's why politically it is a disaster for whoever is in power at the time. But there it is. You're seeing this is the action of the Fed to ultimately, this will begin to fall. How long will it take? Well, the Fed is trying to convey we're dead serious. If the markets believe the Fed, and the Fed is trying its best to say, look at what we're doing, we should be able to see the expected inflation premium begin to drain within the next couple of months. And then once it gets back down, the expected inflation premium gets back down to what we would consider a decent rate, maybe 1%, 2%. Then the Fed will begin to release the money supply, and you'll see that vertical curve start to come back out again, and then you'll see interest rates go down more. So that means that we'll see a strong recovery, but it probably won't happen until the first quarter of 2023. This is, the one point that I'm trying to make here is that when you listen to the people on the extremes of the left and the right, they're politicizing what is engineering, what is just the nature of the beast, and what has to be done when it has gotten out of control. You're not going to get it back under control by being nice to it. And in this case, the economy is going to suffer some. Interest rates, I mean, geez, mortgage rates on loans, car loans, good grief, all kinds of credit card rates are going through the roof right now. They're really rising. Because all interest rates are underlain by that foundation of R-sub-F, the risk-free rate, which is the sum of the real rate of return and the expected inflation premium. And those two have to be methodically, deliberately, and prejudicially fixed. You can't just hope that they'll fix. You have to do what has to be done. You can't pray that they'll be fixed. You can't have a demonstration that they'll be fixed. You can't have a political speech that they'll be fixed. You have to do the mechanics. That's one of the reasons here in this business college, you see these math, all this math and stuff like that, and these very important chains of thought and researching and citing. It's because we have to do things the right way. We let the masses, look, we're the educated. You are, I am. We have to entertain them. We have to let them have their bitching and their fussing and their fairy tales. But then we have to be back there to take care of the real problems. That's just our job. And no, they're never going to understand what we're doing. And sometimes they might even hang us in the streets, for God's sake. But this is what we have to do. We take the emotion out of it. We take the opinions out of it. And we get the mechanics of it done. I want to point out something here. This risk-free rate, you'll see this in some of the formulas we'll use in this course. R sub F shows up quite a bit. It actually has effects all over the world of business. I mean, for business decision-making, it's kind of hinged. Part of it is hinged on this risk-free rate, where it is. And so when that thing moves around, it moves around a lot of business decision making. And just as a quick point, R sub F is technically theoretical. We can proxy it using the one-year T-bill rate. That's very close to the risk-free rate. It is a real-world shadow of the theoretical animal underneath. It's good enough for us. It's definitely right in the near ballpark. But what is inside of it, these two pieces, we cannot see them separately directly. We have to use some pretty heavy-duty math to get a picture of what each one is. The Fed does this, and so do private analysts, and I do it too. But it's in physics, we have a version of this. For example, in quantum physics, and we have many examples of this. In quantum physics, we know that protons and neutrons and those kinds of particles are made up of things inside them called quarks. We'll never be able to see a quark directly. We can mathematically model it. We can know everything about it. But to visually see it, you couldn't. It can't be done. And that's a kind of like what happens here with this. We understand them. We can do all kinds of estimations of what they are, their position, their momentum, and all that. But they are, at the heart of it, still kind of like shadows of what's really going on. So to a little bit of an extent, we're kind of feeling in the dark as we move forward. We use very powerful mathematics to tease it seems kind of odd that these two simple things would be so hard to see, but they really are. But we can figure them out to the extent that we need to. So we get this risk-free rate. This is a substrate. All interest rates are built upon this risk-free rate. They're all something that is this risk-free rate plus what we call a group of risk premia. And there are three of them. Now, each one has a specific size in a given interest rate. So, for example, these three would each be a different number for a home loan, mortgage rate, from what it would be for a car loan, or a credit card, or a student loan. Now, the first of these is a juicer called the default premium. It's a little extra scratch, a little extra boost on the interest rate for the possibility that the borrower is going to default on part or all of the loan. So in other words, you are a great credit risk. Okay, great. But he is an evil scoundrel. He's going to default. So what I have to do is on the interest rate I charge you to, I have to put a little juice for the chance that he is going to burn the group of you by defaulting. So we put on, and we measure interest rates. You're going to hear me turn, I think I've told you this before, but I want to repeat it now. We use the term basis points. A basis point is 1/100th of an interest of a percent. So in other words, I might add a default premium for a home loan of maybe 40 basis points. In other words, 0.4%. Just because some people might default. So I want to cover myself for that possibility. That's all that is. Now, interestingly enough, the default premium will be different for different kinds of loans. For example, a home loan, that actually has a very low default premium because if you default, I take your house back so I can be made whole. Okay? On a credit card loan, I mean, a lot of people default and there's nothing I can take from you if you default on me. So a credit card would have a big default premium. It could be on the order of 600 to 1,000 basis points because so many people default. So everyone has to pay more because of the defaulters. The default premium is different. Usually if a loan is collateralized, it'll have a lower default premium. Now a car loan actually has, obviously there's a car backing the loan, but when a car is driven off the lot, it loses a lot of some of its value. So that default premium is going to probably be higher than the default premium on a home loan. A student loan has a very low default premium because their collection methods are from hell. They'll get their money from you, even if they have to put you into a blender and sell your chewed up kidneys. So the next one is some extra scratch, add basis points, for how long the loan is. You see, this actually comes from physics, but the longer term a loan is, the more likely the interest rates prevailing will have changed. Think about it in physics. If you've got a vacuum and you've got a nozzle that's releasing a gas, when the gas first comes out, it's in a stream. But as it goes further in the glass, it begins to expand. That's what happens with interest rates. Time creates uncertainty. As there's more time on the loan, interest rates could do all kinds of weird things that would be adverse to the banker, to the lender. So in other words, a five-year car loan would have a lower maturity premium than a 30-year home loan would have, simply because over 30 years, there's more chance that interest rates are going to wobble around. And I'll explain why that's bad either way for a lender. But that's something. Now, interestingly enough, a government treasury bill doesn't have a default premium. The government will not default on its debt. Okay? Think about it. A 1 year, there's no maturity premium because it's very short term. But the default premium, but in a 30-year treasury, there's a maturity premium. But in neither the 1 year nor the 30-year will there be a default premium because the government will not default. Well, I heard that they could default. No, they can't. The government will pay you back. First, they can print the money if they need to pay you back. That's what they do all the time anyway. Second, if the printing machines break, well, they could raise taxes, cause a lot of problems, but they could raise taxes to pay you back. Or third, what we've done, you know, if all else fails, we'll just lie about some country offending us and attack them and liquidate their assets. We do that, okay? We're America, for God's sake. Yeah, most recently, Iraq. Before that, Vietnam. Well, we tried anywhere. It didn't work very well, but hell. Anyway. Okay, now there's one last one here. Now, you'll hear me sometimes. It used to be called the liquidity premium. Nowadays, it's called the illiquidity premium, Arcibel. Here's how that works. Most people have no idea that when a bank makes a loan to you, a home loan, a mortgage loan, the bank sells that within probably a couple of hours. Banks do not want to have loans, to own loans. They package their loans up for a day. A bank makes 50 home loans in a day. They'll package those 50 loans up and they will sell them to what's called a secondary mortgage market. Ginnie Mae, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. These are massive, ultra-trillion-dollar, vast pools of money that buys these, of capital, that buys these mortgages. They buy them, and then they make them into super, super ginormous bonds. They carve them up all kinds of ways, and that's where giant, vast oceans of capital that are held by powerful countries, by trust funds, by some corporations, they invest in those ginormous balls of mortgage loans. Well, I pay my bank that mortgage. Well, all they do is service it. They are the front man for the loan. And they've gotten rid of it because they don't want to hold loans. They're not in that business. They get a little money for servicing the loan, but they certainly don't want the exposure, the risk of a loan. So they dump it off into the secondary mortgage markets. If a loan can be removed from your books and you get your money back really fast, it has no liquidity premium or a very little one. But if it's a loan where the bank can't get rid of it and it's stuck with it, it can't sell it, it can't offload it to get its money back, that would have a high liquidity premium. So, for example, a car loan, banks really can't get rid of those. They can't. They're stuck with those. So the bank lends you $20,000 for your car. And so, you know, they would like to sell that to someone else so they can have their money back. They probably can't. So they're going to be stuck with it. So they're going to charge you a higher interest rate because they are bearing a risk that they would otherwise prefer not to bear. So some kinds of loans, and I mean, back in the day, credit cards used to have very high liquidity premiums because a bank couldn't sell its credit card loans to anyone else. It was stuck with those credit card loans and all of the risk they had. So those were highly illiquid securities to the bank. But these days, things are a little different. But so that liquidity premium can be there in some cases. For certain interest rates, it's high. For a mortgage loan, there's virtually no liquidity premium because they can sell those. They're organized, push a button, sell the loan within a couple hours of. In fact, nowadays, from what I understand about this, and I'm speaking of something that I've just learned recently, banks are actually not even making the loan. They're actually just serving as a representative of investors, of ginormous investors, who then work with Ginnie Mae, Freddie Mac, and Sally Mae. Where I found that out was I was at a closing a while back, and the bank official said, "Our investors." And she said that several times, and suddenly I realized, the bank isn't making this loan. The bank is merely being sort of like a representative of something that was not the bank that was actually doing the loan. So that was kind of a jump, because in the old days, the bank would make the loan and then they'd immediately sell it. But this sounds like a lot of banks now, or at least some banks, are actually not even that $130,000 for that loan. The bank did not have that at all. It merely was representing and had the authority to sign the check for this other entity that I didn't even see its name. I was curious about that, but I wasn't the buyer, so let me have a look at those documents. They didn't want to let me do that. But so you see that's kind of showing up here now. But anyway, you put all those together. The risk-free rate that's there always. And then whatever the combination of R sub D, R sub M, and R sub L is, that forms an interest rate that you would see with your own eyes in the economy. That's where all of this is gone. And then the details of interest rates and some of the other stories behind how interest rates form, that's part of what we do when we look at the lecture on Wednesday. But for now, that's all I have for you. I thank you.